Alan Ruth, the conservative warrior. My show, War Now, airs every day right here on USA Radio from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern. I'm also the star of the Wayne Alan Ruth Show on Newsmax TV, reaching over 50 million homes. But my favorite role is speaker extraordinaire. I was opening speaker at many Donald Trump for President events. I speak at Republican, conservative, and college GOP events, and I'm available to be the star at your next event. Contact me to arrange for a Wayne Ruth keynote speech. Call toll-free 888-444-ROOT. That's 888-444-ROOT. Or email wayneroot@gmail.com.
Nathan Latka started his first company in his Virginia Tech dorm room at the age of 20. Within 4 years, he'd hired 40 people and grew the company to $5 million in sales. He walked away from a $6.5 million acquisition offer from that company when he was 23 years old. Latka is author of a new book titled How to Be a Capitalist Without Any Capital, and one of the things he discusses in that book is why sometimes you need to be willing to work smarter. I asked him what it means to work smarter.
Well, I think what a lot of people do is they set goals, and it's so dangerous to set goals. Where people build wealth, and how I've built wealth over the past 10 years, I'm 29 today, so this started back in college, was I focused on building systems, not goals. And you see these systems in the book as I stack them on page 123. You see systems I used to launch my podcast, The Top Entrepreneurs. Now it has 10 million downloads, there's a lot of revenue, but it's important to think in systems, not goals.
All right, well, you mentioned your podcast. So in that podcast, you interviewed CEOs. And what is there a common thread when you're doing these interviews with the CEO that each of these CEOs has, whether that's a skill, whether that's a trait or a characteristic?
Well, Tim, it's just really any founder of a company, and I have them on, and I have to tell you, this is, you know, I'm not very popular. I think I'm the most sued podcaster, and the reason is, Tim, I hit these founders really hard. I mean, I ask them, what's your revenue? How many customers do you have? What was your valuation on your last round of funding if you raised capital?
You can find us on Facebook at USA Radio. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health in Hunterdon County.
Don't fear technology. Use it, understand it, and embrace it. The mission of Tech Today is to demystify technology. I'm your host, Chris Bianco, principal of Blue Panther Business Partners. Every Tuesday morning from 10 to 11, we will cover new apps, buying advice, technology news, and answer your questions. Good day, and join me on Tech Today on HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
And now, it's the news.
You're listening to Now It's the News. I'm Beowulf Rocklin. We're speaking today with Elaine Weiss. She's the author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. It's a story about the battle for the vote for women in 1920 and what led up to that. Elaine Weiss, welcome to Now It's the News. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Derek.
So I thought I knew pretty well the general outline of how the fight for the 19th Amendment played out, but I'm learning by reading your book that it's a lot more complicated than I thought it was. First of all, tell us a little bit, if you will, about the background for the fight, what led up to the proposal, and then a passage by Congress, and then and the passage by the states of the 19th Amendment. Primarily, I learned that there was a very powerful a female-led anti-suffragist a movement. That is something that I was not aware of. Explain a little bit about that, if you could.
Yes. So when my book opens, it is the summer of 1920, and the 19th Amendment, which grants the vote to all American women in every state, in every election, is poised on the cusp of ratification, has to be ratified by 36 of the states, having gone through Congress, and now 35 have ratified it. It needs one more, and the fight comes down to the legislature of Tennessee, and they might be the 36th, or they might not, and that would actually be devastating to the suffragists. So this is the culmination, sort of the Alamo of the whole movement. The movement, the demand for the vote has been going on for 72 years by 1920.
Right.
There's three generations of women who have been fighting for it, hundreds and hundreds of state and local and national battles. The what we call the 19th Amendment was introduced 42 years before. So it's been a very long slog with many, many battles in between. And now it comes down to this historic confrontation, and you have the suffragists come from all over the nation to Nashville for the fight. You have political operatives from the political parties come down because it's a presidential election coming up in November of 1920, and they are nervous about this unpredictable block of women possibly entering the electorate. You have corporate interests who are opposed to women getting the ballot for business reasons, which I detail in the book. And there are ideological foes. There are clergymen who think this will be the downfall of American civilization and goes against God's plan for women. And then you have this fascinating cohort of women who are called the antis. These are the women who oppose their sisters getting the vote. And they have a variety of reasons. Many times they're religiously or culturally conservative and believe women's place is in the home and the vote is going to corrupt her and will destroy the American family. So there are all these reasons, all these contesting forces pile into Nashville in the summer of 1920, and it's a very dramatic 6-week fight that I detail in the book.
It's interesting that it takes place in Nashville. Certainly in this day and age, you would think of that as a locus of cultural conservatism. What was the tenor of politics in Nashville at that time, especially as regarded the rights of women?
Well, Nashville actually turns out to be an interesting state. It's certainly not the dream state for the suffragists. It is a southern state, and by this time, most of the other states of the old Confederacy have defeated the 19th Amendment. They've refused to ratify. And there are racial aspects to the arguments against it. There are cultural arguments in the South. And so this is not a great place for the suffragists to have to stand their ground. That said, Tennessee is considered more progressive than some of the other states in the South. And it also has a strong suffrage infrastructure. It has many strong women organizations that are fighting for it. So in some ways, it's atypical of the South in that it is more strongly pro-suffrage in some ways, but it represents the South in many cultural and political ways. It's also the center of industry, so the railroads are very strong there. The liquor industry is very strong there. The textile manufacturing industry is very strong, and they all oppose suffrage and try to act their will on the legislature, and that's the fight that we see.
We're speaking with Elaine Weiss. She's the author of The Women's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Just backing up for a moment, something that you mentioned earlier fascinated me. I hadn't realized that you had
a 40-year span between when the legislation was introduced, the amendment, and when it was finally ratified by the states. When did the Congress finally end up passing it, and what were those 40 years, two generations, really like?
Oh, yeah. It is an amendment to the Constitution. There are two ways for women to be granted the right to vote. Actually, the power of the vote resides with the states. Right. They can make election laws. And, of course, we see that happening right now as different states decide on, mm-hmm. on different means of access to the vote. So it's the states that can decide, but it's – and some states do, but it's quite clear that not all states are going to give their women to vote. And the a constitutional amendment to make it broad across the board, across the nation, is introduced into Congress by Friends of the Suffrage Movement in 1878.
Wow.
And they and it gets just put in a file drawer. Every year the suffragists march up to Capitol Hill in Washington, and they testify. And they plead and they explain why this is only simple justice, that they are equal citizens, that they are taxpayers. This is taxation without representation. They give all the very well-considered arguments, and the congressmen look at them and say, oh, that's nice. They put it in a drawer, and then they go through it again the next year. This goes on for over 40 years. Finally, after World War I, is the time when women have proven their service. They've served the nation in many ways they'd never served before, as in the industry, as farmers. They've taken on roles they've never taken on before. And now the argument that they don't deserve the vote is really getting hollow, and even the men are realizing this really is not right. And so there's more momentum in Congress. There's also a few states, like large states like New York State, California, Washington State, Illinois, where the state legislatures have given women the vote. And so now there are a few women who actually can vote for president and sometimes for their congressman. So they have a little bit more sway. And so finally, the House of Representatives, the Congress passes the amendment in 1918. But the Senate still sits on it for another year and a half and does not pass the amendment till June of 1919. And it's an off year, and the legislatures in many states are not in session. And that means they have to call special sessions. They make it particularly difficult. But they've done this. The suffragists have gone to every state and rallied, have held rallies and parades and lobbying, and they've gotten 35 states, and now this is the 36th, and everything comes down to Tennessee.
Wow. Well, it's a fascinating story. I don't want to give too much away, but a spoiler alert, the suffragists win. So, but it really.
But I want to make it so that you don't realize that.
No. I get that. And to me, the fascinating part is the political battle that takes place in Nashville, and the real, you know, political and media circus that becomes. And I urge folks to get the book and check that out, because it really is an amazing tale. Elaine Weiss, she's the author of The Women's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Thank you so much for being here with us, and thank you for filling out the education that I only received partially growing up. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Now It's the News. I'm Beowulf Rockland.
We're Sound Income Strategies, and baby boomers who work with us know the secret to a great retirement is our middle name, income. At Sound Income Strategies, we transform high-fee, high-taxed retirement spend-down schemes into sustained retirement income. And we can do the same for you. For your free, no-obligation income kit,
call 866-913-1234. That's 866-913-1234.
It's time to get off the Wall Street Street roller coaster. Stop the retirement spend down schemes and join the income generation. For your free no obligation income kit,
call 866-913-1234. That's 866-913-1234.
Investment advisory services offered through Sound Income Strategies LLC, an SEC registered investment advisory firm.
Sound Income Strategies. The secret to a great retirement is our middle name.
Call 866-913-1234.
Have you written a book and want to get it published? Then we suggest you call Page Publishing at 1-800-658-8202 immediately. That's 1-800-658-8202. Page Publishing is looking for authors of all types of books. And unlike most publishers, Page Publishing will take the time to review each and every book submitted to us. And we will give you our feedback. And if we like what we read, we'll get your book into bookstores and for sale online at Amazon, the Apple iTunes Store, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. We handle everything. Editing, cover design, copyright protection, printing, publicity, and distribution. So if you've written a novel, children's book, cookbook, inspirational work, poetry, or biography, and want to get it published, then you need to call Page Publishing and do it immediately. Call 1-800-658-8202 now for your free author submission kit. Numerically, that's 1-800-658-8202. Again, for your free author submission kit, call 1-800-658-8202. That's 1-800-658-8202. Your road to fame and fortune could very well start with a simple phone call. Call Page Publishing at 1-800-658-8202 for your free author submission kit.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in that critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Retail Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
This is Tony Clark, paraplanner at Patton Heide & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heide & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heide & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody right there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in? Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
And now, it's the news.
You're listening to Now It's the News. I'm Beowulf Rocklin.
We often like to delve back into the history of the United States and the history of the various military operations in which we've been involved, and we frequently do so with regard to World War II. One of the stories that doesn't get as much attention as it should is the story of the Flying Tigers and their involvement in efforts against Japan. We're speaking today with Sam Kleiner. He is the author of The Flying Tigers, the untold story of the American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. Sam, welcome to Now It's the News. Who were the Flying Tigers? What did they do, and how did this play into the balance of power between China and Japan during World War II?
Thanks so much. It's an absolutely fascinating history, and I think a lot of listeners might be familiar with the famous image of the shark-faced P-40, or might have seen the John Wayne movie, The Flying Tigers from 1942. But the real story of the Flying Tigers is even better than the one that Wayne invented for Hollywood. The war between Japan and China goes back to 1937 when the Japanese invaded China. And at the time, there were a handful of Americans, if you can believe it, including Claire Chennault, who was over in China advising the Chinese Air Force. And Chennault is kind of this classic underdog character who had been an army pilot who had been kind of disgruntled and didn't fit in with the rigidity of the army. So he took up what seemed like a crazy proposition, leaving behind his wife and seven kids and going to China to start over, and quickly found himself enamored with Chinese culture and with Madame Chiang Kai-shek, who was the kind of de facto commander of the Chinese Air Force. And so what happens is the war goes on there and it gets worse and worse. The Chinese decide they need more assistance from the Americans. And so in 1941, at the highest levels of the Roosevelt administration, there are conversations with representatives from the Chinese government about sending over a secret unit of 100 American pilots, a couple hundred ground crew, and 100 P-40 planes as the plan comes together to assist the Chinese. But obviously, this would be an act of war. So this goes on completely in secret. The word kind of gets out, but this is obviously done through means that are designed to kind of keep this secret.
And just to be clear, this was prior to Pearl Harbor.
Exactly. So this is all prior to Pearl Harbor, and so that's something that most Americans don't know. I think we tend, you know, in our history classes to talk about World War II, something that happened from December 7th, 1941, up through VJ Day. But this is actually a much more complicated and I think interesting history. One of the great untold stories from the Greatest Generation is this band of pilots and ground crew who go over on this mission, and they don't know about a lot of the, you know, the kind of backdoor machinations that are going on, and they don't really know much about China or Burma, but they are promised money, a great adventure, and for many of these guys are, you know, children of the Great Depression. Many of them have hardly left the counties they grew up in, and this is a big opportunity for them, and they seize at it. And so, you know, you get these kind of larger-than-life pilots, guys like Pappy Boyington or David Tex Hill, who sign up for the unit, and they become legends. And that was, you know, just a cultural difference between the U.S. now and then is, you know, these guys... front page stories. Everyone knew about, you know, these individual pilots, and they kind of, you know, they became legends in their own time. But quickly, the memory has disappeared. And what I wanted to do, I'm 31 years old. My grandfather was a navigator on a B-25 in the Pacific, and wanted to bring this story back to life. So I think it's important that we honor this, honor the legacy of this unit. It's right before Memorial Day, and many of these guys didn't survive, and I wanted to make sure that we paid tribute to them. And I think it's an important story that tells us even today about the relationship between the U.S. and China.
We're speaking with Sam Kleiner. He's the author of The Flying Tigers, the untold story of the American pilots who waged a secret war against Japan. I'm wondering, just to back up and provide a little bit more context, it's interesting to me that this was authorized by the Roosevelt administration in what was essentially a covert act of war, and yet, despite repeated pleas by Great Britain for involvement, and I suppose you could count the Lend-Lease program, but nothing so overt as this, nothing that I'm aware of at any rate that was on a military level where actual troops, military personnel were involved. Why was this more important to us at that time, prior to Pearl Harbor, than was the European theater?
Well, I think there was a lot of assistance that was going on to Great Britain as well. You know, even before Lend-Lease, there's this thing called the Destroyers for Bases deal, where we send over 50 destroyers to help Great Britain. And this was, you know, actually, you know, from the Chinese perspective, they were concerned that they weren't going to get any assistance because all of the focus was on Europe. And in some ways, I think the fact that, you know, the isolationist movement was more focused on what was happening in Europe than was happening in Asia kind of allowed this to happen more, you know, without as much attention and, you know, know, there's a report in Time magazine as these guys are starting to leave their bases saying, you know, these American pilots are leaving their bases, and, you know, there's rumors that they're going to fight the secret as part of the secret unit in China. But there wasn't as much attention paid to the war that was happening in the Pacific at the time. So they were kind of, in some ways, the Roosevelt administration was a little bit freer to act, I would think, in the Pacific theater. But, you know, so many of these guys, what made it an incredible story in telling it for this book is that these pilots and ground crew kept incredible diaries and wrote these incredible letters home to their families that allow you to experience it, not only, you know, the decision-making that was happening in Washington, but through the eyes of these guys. And over the past couple of years, I've gotten to spend time at the reunions going and talking to the family members, becoming close with who's now the last surviving member of the Flying Tigers. And I think the book benefits from having, you know, a ton of stuff that's never been seen before, including the combat reports these pilots filled out that really allow the reader to get in the cockpit with them and experience what it was like to be there.
What were the Flying Tigers able to accomplish, and how did things change once we officially entered World War II?
So the first battle they have, and this is one of the misconceptions that kind of lingers because the Wayne movie, where all their battles are before Pearl Harbor in the Wayne movie. But in reality, the first battle they fight is December 20th, 1941. They take on a group of Japanese bombers over Kunming, China. The Japanese had basically been bombing imperviously for years. And the Americans take to the air, take down a number of Japanese bombers. And this becomes one of the great stories when America really needed heroes and needed victories. The Flying Tigers are first announced in Time magazine on December 29th, 1941, amidst all the coverage of the destruction of Pearl Harbor and the series of losses around the Pacific, as a kind of unit that's taking on the Japanese and winning. And that helped to bolster America's morale. It's why John Wayne quickly seized on the idea, and they rush out the movie that comes out in 1942. And it really helped to bolster America's sense that we could fight and win this war. There's a lot more I'd love to share, but listeners are welcome to go to flyingtigersbook.com to read more about this and see a lot of photos that have never been published before. And obviously there's a ton more in the book coming from, you know, this extensive research into all of these combat reports, letters and diaries, and a lot of unpublished photos that have never been seen before.
Well, that's fantastic, and thank you for making that available. And it's a really fascinating story, and it certainly came to America first at a time where the idea that we were going to win the war was by no means a certainty. Our first 6 months of involvement in the Pacific were actually a quite a big string of defeats, if I'm remembering my history correctly. And
you've got it absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. And the Flying Tigers were certainly an exception to that. Not only a fascinating story, but a point of light in the darkness as well at that time. We've been speaking with Sam Kleiner, the author of The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. Thanks very much for being with us today, Sam.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I hope everyone enjoys the book.
You're listening to Now It's the News. I'm Beowulf Rockland.
Wouldn't it be great to see your windows in a whole new light? Do it right. Call your local neighborhood experts. Budget Blinds. You'll get beautiful style and personalized service for every budget. We bring the showroom right to your home, so you can choose from hundreds of blinds, shades, shutters, and drapes. Plus smart home window coverings you control with the touch of a button. And with Budget Blinds, we do it all for you. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy. There's a reason why Budget Blinds is the number one provider of custom window coverings in North America. When we say we have style and service for every budget, we really mean it. So let's get your home a whole lot of gorgeous. Get your free consultation right at home. Just go online to budgetblinds.com or call 855-BUDGET-BLINDS. Call 855-BUDGET-BLINDS for your free consultation right at home. Now that's beautiful. At participating independently owned and operated franchises only. Ask for details.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
The U.S. economy added 20,000 jobs last month. Now, economists were expecting right around 180,000 jobs. President Trump, though, is downplaying that report. Outside the White House, he spoke about the overall economy.
The unemployment rate just went lower. We're down now to 3.8%, so we had very good news in that. I think the big news really was that wages went up.
President Trump is currently seeing some of the tornado damage in Alabama firsthand and then heading to Florida to his Mar-a-Lago resort. President Trump says he would be very disappointed if North Korea resumes missile testing. The president has held two summits on denuclearization with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, Republican Congressman of New York Peter King on North Korea.
You know, I didn't trust North Korea then. I don't trust them now. The fact is, all that's going to work with them is constant pressure and letting them know that we're not going to back down.
King was speaking there on Fox News. This is USA Radio News.
Get the hottest flooring styles at incredible prices at Lumber Liquidators' Spring Black Friday Flooring Sale. All waterproof floors are on sale up to 50% off. Get a dollar off per square foot on select Bellawood hardwood floors and take 20% off new AquaSeal water-resistant laminate. Plus, ask how you can get professional installation and special financing. Get to Lumber Liquidators' Spring Black Friday Flooring Sale today. Visit LumberLiquidators.com for a store near you.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
And now, it's the news.
You're listening to Now It's the News. I'm Beowulf Rockland. Today, we are speaking with Rob Long. He is the editor of Bigly, Donald Trump in Verse. Yes, the poetic fashionings of our commander-in-chief. Rob Long, welcome to Now It's the News. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to give you just a brief example of what you have collected here in terms of the poetry of Donald Trump. So let me put on my best poetry reading voice and see if I can sally forth here. Whining and winning. I do whine because I want to win, and I'm not happy about not winning. And I am a whiner, and I keep whining and whining until I win. So that's a sampling of what you will be seeing in Bigly. When did you first notice the presidential penchant for poetry?
Well, you know, I think it was during the primaries, probably. He was giving a speech, and, you know, he kind of like the beginning of the speech and the end of the speech are pretty much planned, but in the middle it all goes kind of scrambled eggs. And he starts to, he starts to kind of free verse, and there's a little bit of rap in there, and it just kind of loses the format, which I think is when he's at his most free. Hmm. And I was listening to it, I said, boy, you know, that sounds like, you know, a rap battle or a free verse or a poetry slam or anything that, you know, these kids do. Or even just modern poetry, And so I took a speech, I forget which one, and I just arranged it on the page in poetic form. And my only rule was I could not add a word, subtract a word, or rearrange the word. So everything had to be just as he said it. And lo and behold, there it was. It was poetry, and it kind of worked. And I started. I kept doing it. And obviously, some speeches were more poetic than others. You know, the tweets were easy because that's basically a haiku already. You know, he kind of already had done that for me. But the rest of it, it just kind of came together. And I went all the way back. I mean, I went back into the late 80s or early 90s for some poems from interviews and TV appearances. And, you know, he's got a remarkably consistent voice for a poet, right? Mm-hmm. He's been 30 right. years. I mean, whether he knows it or not, he is the poet-in-chief.
Do you feel that he was influenced at all by the Sarah Palin stream of consciousness school?
Well, I think he was definitely influenced by Well, you know, he's a creature of the media, so I don't know whether he was influenced by it or he influenced it.
Interesting.
But if you're in the public eye for 30 years, 40 years, you develop a certain kind of freedom, I think, and that's what these poems really reflect, is this kind of his freedom. And, you know, and look, you know, love him or hate him, you have to be able to. He is a singular way of communicating. The guy really knows how to talk. And this is kind of how I see it, how I express it, just simply by saying that he's got a rhythm. He's got rhythm.
Hey, who could ask for anything more? We're speaking with Rob Long. He is the author of, or rather the editor of, Bigly, Donald Trump in Verse. Many great poets, Shakespeare, Poe among them, have invented their own words, and certainly the title of this edition counts. Do you think that Bigly is Trump's greatest creation, verbally speaking?
Well, look, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Great poets make up words, but they make up words that instantly make sense. They make up words where you think to yourself, boy, that's an expressive word. He couldn't possibly have made it up. We needed it. And, you know, there's a grand tradition of Anglo-Saxon words being sort of shoved out of the English language by Latinate words, you know. And and Trump is a very, very strict Anglo-Saxon kind of guy.
Yes.
Not many words. He doesn't have that many. But Bigly, I mean, some people say he said Big League.
Right.
And I think in some recordings, I think I'm pretty sure he is saying Big League. But he's also, I think, in a few saying Bigly. And Bigly, I don't know, it has a snap to it. I mean, we could have said large or big or largely, I guess. But the English language,
right,
especially in the hands of a master like Trump, is saying something in a slightly different way to kind of get you to sit up straight.
It's interesting, and I hear what you're saying. You're right. It's a very Germanic, Anglo-Saxon composition in terms of how you would approach
right.
A word formation. Do you think that the commander in chief will advocate building a linguistic wall around those Anglo-Saxon words in order to keep the Latin derivatives out?
Oh, well, you know, it's way too late for that. But I also feel like, as like any great poet, he wants to have as many, you know, arrows in his quiver as possible. So, you know, a great poet won't give up any words. You want to keep adding words. I mean, it's certainly not exactly in sync with his immigration policy, but the English language is something that actually has vastly improved by immigration.
We're speaking with Rob Long, the editor of Bigly, Donald Trump in Verse. What do you think of a lot of these repeated, recurring phrases or lines that seem to me, at least, to be derived from his upbringing in New York City? You know, believe me, I can tell you, that sort of thing. How does that fit into his poetic scheme?
Well, look, I mean, you know, poets have those little tropes they reach to. Eliot did, and Shakespeare, you mentioned Shakespeare did. I mean, Homer did, you know, the rosy fingers of
rosy
dawn,
finger
and
dawn,
the dark sea.
And darkness covered his eyes, and yeah.
Yeah, like all those things. And it's sort of natural. I don't think Donald Trump is a student of poetry, but I think he kind of intuitively knows that. I mean, Snoop Dogg does the same thing, and so does Kanye West. So, when your words are your business, you tend to use them in the most efficient, but also in the most impactful way. And that, I think, is big for him. I mean, he really does have a knack for saying something in an arresting way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, that's why he's in the White House. That's why he has so many followers. That's also why he has so many detractors. I mean, you know, you can't have one without the other. And when I was put together the book, what I was hoping to do is, like, hoping to come up with a book that was fun and light and funny enough that if you were, you know, a never-Trumper and you don't like the guy at all, that you could laugh at it. But if you were wearing a MAGA hat and you love the guy, you could laugh at it and enjoy it. Because the truth is that, you know, all we do these days, you watch cable news and yell and scream at each other.
Uh-huh.
It'd be nice to take a little break from that. And I promise, after you take the break, you can go right back to it if it's so important. You know?
No, I think you've developed something here which can be appreciated by both sides.
you know, we've heard recently that Twitter is going to be doubling their number of characters, and obviously the president of the United States works largely in Twitter as far as his poetry. Perhaps it's a sort of limiting haiku-like structure. But I wonder, do you think that will kind of hinder his verse style or cause it to flower even further?
You know, I don't know. I'm nervous. I think that all of those restrictions and all of those rules make you better. Mm-hmm. I don't think Donald Trump needs another 140 characters. I think he's got the 140 he's got have been worked pretty well for him. Were I he, I would refuse to do it. I would just stay with what I can do. You know, you never really, you know, look, you know, the guy's 70 years old. He's not, the way he communicates is the way he communicates. He's not really going to learn anything new. Yeah. And he's mastered 140 characters. Where I his advisors, I'd say stick with that. I'm sure. I mean, if the White House is being run the way I think it's being run, they're probably having top level meetings about it right now.
We've been speaking with Rob Long. He is the editor of Bigly, Donald Trump in Verse. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Billions and billions and
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 billions and billions and billions and
billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and
billions. For more information on Now It's the News, go to nowitsthenews.com.
Here's some great news. If you missed the deadline to sign up for health insurance, or more importantly, if you sign up for a plan that you're just not happy with, you still have a choice. It's called MediShare, and MediShare is a Christian healthcare sharing program. It's been around for 25 years. They have more than 400,000 members now around the country. And get this, over the years, MediShare members have shared more than $2 billion of each other's medical bills, so they could help share your needs too. And best of all, you could save a lot of money with MediShare. The typical savings for a family is around $500 a month. Your savings could be more or less, but think about what you could do with that extra money every month. So if you think you're stuck with a high-cost health plan that doesn't have much to offer, think again. You can join MediShare anytime, so call them today and check it out. There's no pressure. They're super easy to talk to. 855-90-BIBLE. That's 855-90-BIBLE. 855-90-BIBLE.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Are you struggling to find the right person to stay in that critical role in your company? Trying to attract and retain millennials? Regional Personnel is your staffing solution. Located in Lebanon, New Jersey, Regional Personnel is an ASA-certified, privately held staffing and recruiting firm providing you with everything from temporary to permanent employees. As ASA-certified professionals, we employ the latest tools and techniques to find, screen, and present to you the best talent that fits your needs. The result? Access to top talent in the shortest time with the lowest chance of turnover. We guarantee it. So call Regional today at 908-534-8113 or visit us on the web at regionalpersonnel.com.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody right there!
Get involved!
Did you know? The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. The Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
And now, it's the news.
You're listening to Now It's the News. I'm Beowulf Rocklin. Today we're speaking with Jessica Bruder. She is the author of Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. Jessica, welcome to Now It's the News. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the open road. It used to be something that Americans aspired to, getting out there, traveling across the country, traveling in an RV, maybe even living in one. It seemed to be a promise of freedom. But your investigation that you conducted and written up in this book really seems to be the opposite. It seems to be what people are doing on the way down as opposed to doing on the way up.
Yeah, it's funny. Whenever I saw an RV, back before I started working on this book project, I assumed that the occupants were probably the last of the great pensioners, you know, enjoying their golden years on some secure savings and, you know, going to see everything from Old Faithful to Niagara Falls and just, you know, writing postcards along the way. And it just seemed like this really just charmed existence. And while those people, by all means, are still out there, they've been joined by a whole new group of folks who have really been battered around by the economy, particularly in a society where we still have, you know, $7.25 is our federal minimum wage and housing costs keep going up. And for a lot of people, that's put them in a pretty untenable situation, for which going mobile has, you know, has kind of been the valve that releases some of the pressure.
I certainly see people in my neck of the woods, and I live in southern Oregon, who use RVs or trailers as basically their in-law unit. I mean, this is their plan for a retirement or to help their parents. And I think it seems to me that's something born of economic necessity. Also, how have some of the people that you've talked to made the decision that I can't afford a home anymore, and this is what I'm going to do instead?
Yeah, I mean, the stories are as unique as the people themselves, but for a lot of people, in general, 2008 was a wake-up call. But for people in particular who are on the brink of retirement and suddenly faced, without having time to make it up, losing their savings, possibly losing their 401ks, losing the equity in their homes that they plan to retire on, it was really a particularly dire blow. So I met people out on the road who had, again, lost all of those things, and some of them had pretty high-profile jobs during their main careers, and I also met people who had been caught on the low-wage treadmill and had never been able to put away enough to retire. And, you know, meanwhile, we live in a culture where pensions have been replaced with 401ks. In the 80s, 401ks were cynically marketed as instruments of financial freedom, while really taking the risk off of the shoulders of the employer and moving it over to the worker. And I think that's been kind of a disaster. So we've got all these factors that have people getting out on the road from different economic strata.
We're speaking with Jessica Bruder. She is the author of Nomadland: Surviving America in the 21st Century. You know, what is day-to-day life like for these folks, and is it actually less expensive than what the alternatives are?
I believe it can be less expensive. People envision that folks living this lifestyle are constantly in motion, and that's actually not true. Hmm. Often it's about getting to where you need to be and staying there for a while. Often they drive less than commuters in urban areas do. So for many people, you know, there are thousands of employers who hire these folks over the country, from Amazon hiring them to do warehouse work, which can involve walking 15 miles on a concrete floor on a day, to Texas oil fields that hire them as gate guards, to the annual sugar beet harvest that hires them to work as ground crew, shoveling beets and doing some other pretty tough work on 12-hour shifts, to campgrounds and national parks all over the country. So that's where you'll find these people, is doing these jobs. They are tough jobs. They typically do not pay very well. However, they are one small area of the workforce in which ageism does not seem to be a factor. They are taking all warm bodies and all comers. So a lot of people are working those jobs, and when they're not, they are going financially dormant the best they can. Sometimes they're on public lands where they can camp for free or cheap. Often I see people using solar panels to generate their own electricity because the cost of that technology has come down so incredibly within recent years and put it within reach of a very wide audience. So that's some of the stuff that they're up to.
You know, I hate to draw the parallel, but it kind of seems like you've created a latter-day version of the Grapes of Wrath here. I mean, there's basically a motorized itinerant a class that's burgeoning in America, and that it seems on the face of it that it can't be good.
I think it's pretty challenging, and one of the big differences between these folks who are out on the road now related to economic circumstances and people who were out in the aftermath of the Great Depression, in my mind, is the post-Depression folk always envisioned reintegrating with mainstream society. So everybody was just figured, you know, this is a temporary anomaly. Things are going to get better, and I'll be back in. And meanwhile, today, I don't think people believe that the cavalry is going to come, that things are going to change, that what is starting to feel like a long emergency, you know, in everything from our economy to the climate to just the overarching situation of, you know, how we're going to make it in the world. I don't think people feel like we're going to return to the old quo. I think the idea that we might seems quite clear to them. So most of the people I met were really planning to do this for the long haul. And that was something that surprised me, but it makes sense now.
It's really incredible. Maybe it's more akin to Mad Max than it is to the grapes of wrath. Because I mean, well, yeah. What is the? I mean, what's
the grapes of meth?
The grapes of meth. Like, what's the ultimate end here? I mean, how does somebody live out their life in a situation where at some point they're not going to be able to drive? And if we are, as a society, and hopefully our leaders, realizing that there is a growing group of people who are turning to this because there's no economic alternative, like, what are we going to end up with? A bunch of people driving around, filling the roads and with, fires in oil barrels to light the chiaroscuro. I mean, what's the end game here?
Oh, I wish I knew what the end game was, but I think the trend will continue to grow, and I also think the crackdown on it is going to keep growing. Right now, we have a widespread wave of what people are worriedly referring to as the criminalization of homelessness. Hmm. So in many cities and towns, there's just been a giant wave of new laws making it illegal for people to sleep in their cars, which in my mind is pretty heartless and also an indictment of our values as a society, and that we're saying, okay, here's this little blank patch of land. Your car is good enough to stay there, but not you in the car. I mean, in my mind, that says that we value property over people, and it's kind of a screwed up inversion of how we should be thinking. There's also been a crackdown in the national parks. I just got another email yesterday talking about how people who live full-time in their vehicles are being hustled off the land and sometimes not even given the rights that, you know, every person visiting this public land is entitled to in terms of staying there, which is upsetting to me. And at the same time, you know, places where these people gather, I started hanging out with them in 2013, and the numbers are just swelling. The numbers are absolutely swelling. And, you know, there's an interest in the whole tiny house movement and cheap minimalism, but people never talk about the fact that economic factors actually may be shaping even those factors. And I think there's a lot more of that going on than we realize, because everybody has to find a way to make this acceptable. If this is your daily existence, do you know what I mean? You find a way to integrate it with your life that allows you to get out of bed in the morning every day.
You're right, in to the extent that this is the only option. But ultimately, it would seem that this is an outcropping of a larger problem, which is that we don't have affordable housing in this country, and certainly in places like the San Francisco mm-hmm. Bay Area, where there are people working for enormous companies and often well-paid people who are in this situation that still can't afford basic housing, that's where the problem has to be addressed ultimately. Jessica Bruder, she is the author of Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century. Thank you so much for talking with us about this, and thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks for caring about these people and their stories.
Happy trails.
That's all the time we have today on Now It's the News. Now It's the News was created and produced by yours truly, Beowulf Rocklin. For more information,
go to nowitsthenews.com. Follow us on Twitter at nowitsthenews. And until next week, keep smiling through, just like you always do.
Happy trails!
Mike Hewitt here. This week, Democratic Congresswoman Mary Gay Scanlon used a congressional hearing to compare U.S. Border Patrol officers to Nazis. Seriously, partisanship aside, what's happened to JFK's Democratic Party? Unhinged on illegal immigration, high on socialism, and bent on identity division. Meanwhile, President Trump met a second time with Kim Jong-un. Whatever the outcome, Trump has achieved greater success with North Korea than all of the presidents combined since the signing of the Korean Armistice Agreement in 1954. Even Jimmy Carter supported Trump's efforts. That while Democrats show-dog their convicted perjurer in pursuit of a supreme gotcha moment. If you don't like prosperity and peace, join with the Democrats. Just remember they can only realize their 2020 hopes by tearing the country down. Agree or disagree. Find the Mike Hewitt Show on Facebook and tell us what you think.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
President Trump is visiting storm-ravaged Alabama this afternoon. The White House says the president will get an aerial view of some of the tornado damage after a series of destructive storms hit the area on Sunday. Nearly two dozen people were killed, and the president is also expected to meet with some first responders. Now, before leaving for that trip, the president had some strong words for Democrats after a resolution was passed yesterday condemning hate speech.
I thought yesterday's vote by the House was disgraceful because it's become, the Democrats have become an anti-Israel party. They've become an anti-Jewish party. And I thought that vote was a disgrace. And so does everybody else if you get an honest answer.
Reports say Jake Peterson will plead guilty to kidnapping 13-year-old Jamie Kloss and murdering her parents in Barron County, Wisconsin. This is USA Radio News.
Question, do you have a health insurance plan you are not happy with? Well, Bethany and Jason thought they were stuck. Their plan just kept getting more expensive, and Bethany's favorite doctor didn't even take that plan anymore. And then some friends at church told them about MediShare.
With our previous insurance, we were paying $1,200 a month. With MediShare, we now pay around $600 a month.
Yes, they're paying $600 less per month, and that's a pretty typical savings with MediShare, and they actually like MediShare more.
I was able to go back to my original doctor that I absolutely loved, and it's just been an absolutely beautiful thing being a part of MediShare.
Yeah, so they pay a lot less, and they like it more. No wonder MediShare is growing so fast. Find out more. They're super easy to talk to. All you have to do is call 833-34-BIBLE. That's 833-34-BIBLE. 833-34-BIBLE.
A sweeping government reform bill is headed to the Senate after passage by the House.
The yeas are 234. The nays are 193. The bill is passed.
The Democratic bill tightens government ethic rules and imposes campaign finance violation restrictions, but has little chance of passing in the Senate. Florida Governor Republican Ron DeSantis is being sued. With more on the story, here's USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes.
After new Florida Governor Ron DeSantis suspends the Broward County Sheriff for the botched response to the Parkland school shootings last year, the now former sheriff, Scott Israel, is fighting back with a lawsuit claiming DeSantis' actions were all for political reasons.
This is simply a political payback by a governor who made a campaign promise when he was a candidate.
An investigation found that Israel was responsible for assigning the deputy who took cover outside the school instead of confronting the shooter.
This is USA Radio News.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
Before boarding Air Force One, President Trump took questions from reporters outside the White House. The president was asked about Paul Manafort and his sentence.
I feel very badly for Paul Manafort. I think it's been a very, very tough time for him. But if you notice, both his lawyer, a highly respected man, and a very highly respected judge, the judge, said there was no collusion with Russia. It's had nothing to do with collusion. There was no collusion. It's a collusion hoax. It's a collusion witch hoax. I don't collude with Russia. So I just want to tell you, his lawyer went out of his way, actually, to make a statement last night. No collusion with Russia. The judge, I mean, for whatever reason, I was very honored by it, also made the statement that this had nothing to do with collusion with Russia. So, you know, keep it going. Let's go. Keep the hoax going. Senator Burr said there's no collusion. You look at Devin Nunes and the House Intelligence Committee. They said there's no collusion.
An unemployed New Jersey man who won last Friday's $273 million Mega Millions jackpot said he wants to reward the mystery person who returned the tickets to the store where he'd left them a day earlier. See, the man went in to buy the tickets and said he was so preoccupied with his phone that he left the ticket there. Well, someone turned in those tickets, and one of those tickets ended up being the winner, all $273 million worth. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.